Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. It is the 14th of November, and very nice to have you with us. A couple of notes before we get underway. First of all, just to give you a little bit of insider baseball, there are we really are slaves to the clock, and I'm bad at it. You know, maybe 3 out of 10 times I hit what I'm supposed to. But anyway, there's a clock right in front of us, and then there's a clock to the right. And so the clock right in front of us is offline this morning. So if somewhere around 2 we're still going, just tap me on the shoulder and let me know that we're done. And I think this one's correct, so we're all good. I apologize for that in advance, and I apologize to you, Mike, because you're the one who's going to deal with this as much as possible. But anyway, I'll do my best. I have my little atomic clock in the corner of my computer as well. We had a lovely night last night. A group of us from the station went down for an event on the state of journalism that took place at Gallery 40 in Poughkeepsie. We had our I got to be the interlocutor and host, and we had Sarah Gilbert, our president and CEO, David Krasnow from the New Yorker Radio Hour, the executive producer, Emily Sacker, who is founder of the Daily Catch, and your boss, Casey Seiler, editor of the Times Union. And we had a great, great time, and it was really nice to be out in the community. It was really nice to talk about these very important issues and the importance of community in journalism. And we had a packed house, and it was lovely, and it will air at some point, and we're anxious for you to listen to it. It was a really nice, I think, fruitful discussion. Mostly, let me thank all of the folks at Gallery 40 and the lovely, lovely welcoming that we got. It was really nice. The people of Poughkeepsie are awesome, and it was really fun.
Cool
to be
that people
there.
Showed up for it too.
I mean, yeah, that's it could
be a very wonky discussion.
I said at the beginning, I said, folks, we just sold out an art gallery in Poughkeepsie to talk about journalism. Like, this is awesome. This is it was great. Wow. No, we had a good time. Very, very fun. So just want to thank all of the folks involved in that. Very, very nice to have you here today. Okay, let's go to the introductions of everyone, and we will start the process of this morning's program. Joseph Palamountain, Junior Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Bo Breslin is with us. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I'm great. I'm thrilled to be back with this august group here around me, and I'm very excited for this weekend for two reasons. One, quality time spent with my wife, and two, the Ken Burns American Revolution documentary starts on Sunday. And for somebody like me who spends a lot of his time thinking about late 18th century America, that's about as exciting as it gets.
Very cool.
Very true. Ulster County Controller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, joins us. Good morning, March. How are you?
Good morning. So glad to be here. It's funny what you were saying, Bo, because I was thinking our son, who's 20, who still lives with us, is going to be away this weekend. Me and my husband could do something exciting. And then I was like, what would that be? So yeah, no, never mind. But when I leave here today, I'm going to go to a ribbon cutting for the Golden Hill Housing Project, which has been a collaboration between Family of Woodstock, Penrose, and Ulster County. And I'm really excited. It's going to bring hundreds of units of needed affordable housing online. And it's just a great thing to see that come to fruition. So happy to see that happen.
Wonderful. Congratulations. And thanks for sharing. That's awesome. We go to Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead, Anna Markowitz, is here. Good morning, Anna.
Good morning. And I'm also a Skidmore alumni, so I feel like I'm going to have like a final exam to see if my if anything should be revoked, if they're, you know, but hopefully I pass today.
In all these years, I didn't know you were a skiddy.
Yeah. Yeah. Proud skiddy.
Oh, good for you. That's very cool. Mm-hmm. Excellent. We also welcome editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, is here. Good morning, Jay.
And another Skitty.
Yeah, really?
Oh, is my goodness. Oh, three my out of goodness. Four panelists are That's skitties. Great. We are representing.
Sorry, March.
Yeah,
we should have brought a little banner to like hold up and take a picture.
I just think it's that's great. Oh, that's good.
Game right now yeah. Or yeah. Field hockey.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we don't play sports at Skidmore. Yeah,
right. That's so true. We could get we'll a draw, dance going.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. Draw a picture right. About it.
Great college, great, beautiful campus, absolutely gorgeous campus. And just a quick plug, because we're talking about Skidmore, but on Monday I'll be interviewing Susan Orlean, the famed journalist who has a new book out called Joyride, and known for the library book. And my favorite book of hers is The History of Rin Tin Tin. Mm. Oh, my God, it's so good. Great New Yorker writer, and she'll be at the Palomountain Hall at Skidmore in a North Shire bookstore event on Monday night. You can find out more at northshire.com, and you can find out even more when I talk to her for a preview interview coming up in our 11 o'clock hour. All right, now we can start the show. I don't know what time it is, but we can start the show. Here we go. We have a lot to talk about, and it's been a busy week, a lot going on, no question about it. And so we'll do our best here. A lot of things sort of merge together or kind of smoosh together.
Epstein.
Well, right. And then this the MAGA leaders upset over that the assertion that the U.S. needs foreign workers, and that rift has gotten them upset, as has the Epstein files, and that as well. Meanwhile, the plan on what's going to happen with the congressional push on the Epstein files is something to watch as well. I would like the Epstein story, of course, is in this, but I would like to just focus on the America First part at the beginning, and then we'll get into Epstein. But MAGA leaders erupted this week over President Donald Trump's assertion that the United States needs foreign workers because it does not have enough talented people, questioning the president's commitment to America First politics that he has popularized. A congressional push to release the government's files on sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, a years-long cause on the right, move forward against the wishes of the White House, even as Republicans overwhelmingly dismissed newly released emails Epstein wrote, including some about Trump. And Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Republican, a longtime Trump ally, sparred with the president on multiple fronts after suggesting that the White House was too focused on foreign affairs and denouncing recent aid to Argentina. I'm telling you, if you see Marjorie Taylor Greene on these interviews that she's doing on CNN and MSNBC, I don't know what happened to my human brain. It's so discordant. I don't get it.
Is she the same person?
No.
Is it possible that she's been replaced?
I don't know. I don't know if I'm the same person, quite frankly. The dissent showed an impassioned base willing to challenge Trump on some issues while largely supporting his leadership overall. Trump's critics voiced skepticism that the risk will hurt the president's support in hurt the president's support in any lasting way. But the rare criticism showed the limits of Trump's authority over the America First agenda that he championed as a candidate, and raised some GOP concerns about enthusiasm ahead of the 2026 midterm elections. The president, and I think many of you have seen memes or have seen clips or have seen comedic interpretation of the president with his fun new word, affordability. He's talking as if he had never heard that word before, and now he said there's a new word out, and it's called affordability. And so the last few days has been focused on that. Bo.
So, Joe, is it possible that Marjorie Taylor Greene is an GOP evil genius? And the reason why I asked this question.
Yes, that is possible.
The reason why I asked this question is because I'm going to take a slightly different lens at this, at the criticism that Trump is getting from whether it's on the immigration front or on the Epstein files front. He's been criticized in the past before, and eventually or quickly, the MAGA folks have forgiven him. This one might have a little bit more of a staying power, but what's interesting to me is the fact that at some point soon, the GOP has to decide how to move on from Trump as the demagogue, the autocrat, and the populist sort of band leader. And it's possible that Marjorie Taylor Greene is sort of accelerating that move on. And what I mean by that is, if you look at historically the populists in this country, and from Andrew Jackson to George Wallace, they were all firebrands that could generate enthusiasm from their particular group. But once they lost their place in the political on the political landscape, their political parties and their political movements died down. Is Marjorie Taylor Greene sort of accelerating this post-Trump keep MAGA going mentality? At some point, Trump is going to drop off the political spectrum, and who's going to take that place in this sort of moment in which we're talking about a populist MAGA world? Is it going to be Nick Fuentes? I don't think so. Is it going to be somebody else? But the GOP has to decide who's going to replace Trump. And I think that we're starting to see that movement happening. So I don't know if this is a conscious decision on the part of critics like Laura Ingraham or Marjorie Taylor Greene, but I do think it's we should pay attention. Democrats in particular should pay attention to the reality that Trump will not be on the landscape forever, and there's going to be a continued populist movement beyond it. I think the last thing I'll say here is I think the Democrats have a steeper hill to climb if that accelerated post-Trump era comes more quickly than if it comes in 2028.
Anna.
I mean, I would love for us to be moving on from Trump right now. We unfortunately have three more years, and I don't think he's quite ready to give up the baton of being the leader. I think that this will fade, just like everything seems to fade. I think that he's giving these visas for people who are college educated, who are giving $100,000 to the government and for these visas, and meanwhile is pulling people off the streets with ICE. And I think if we're looking at what the MAGA movement cares more about, they care more about ICE and that type of immigration than they do about this kind of higher echelon of immigrants. I would love to be wrong about that. I personally would love all immigrants to be here, but that's the lens I think they're looking at it through.
I thought that Laura Ingraham looked surprised. I think when she asked Trump, you know, well, don't we have talent here? She expected him to say, yes, we do, and we need some additional. But he said, no, you don't have talent here. And that just, she looked kind of really surprised by that, which made me want to go and see what other conservative commentators are saying. I went on Twitter X to see what people were saying, and I was kind of shocked. I mean, Nick Fuentes said, you know, this is not America first. Trump has not delivered. We were better off with Biden. I kind of was jaw-dropping watching that. I'm not kidding you. Bannon says, you know, this is for the tech bros and oligarchs. That's what this visa mm-hmm. program is for. Tim Pool said, don't worry, quote-unquote, don't worry, Trump is bringing plenty of H-1Bs to make sure our young people are, fill in the blank, I can't say it on radio. And so that was surprising to me. I also saw a lot of criticism for the Trump organization itself having so many people on H-2A and H-2B visas working at Mar-a-Lago, hundreds of people. So I don't know if it'll fade. I hope that it doesn't. I feel like people are digging in on this, wait, what about America First thing? And Trump saying he's the arbiter of what makes America great really upset people, I think.
Quick sideline, but my favorite Steve Bannon quote of the week was him saying, you know what? If this keeps up, I'm going to end up in jail.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, please don't do that. Yes, for God's sakes.
You know, we have written so many times in editorials that I've lost count of how many times we have argued that you need immigration in the United States for all sorts of reasons, whether it's, you know, raw labor, in agriculture, or whether it is talented people who we ought to be doing more to keep in this country and turn into citizens and enjoy the fruits of the American education system, higher education system in helping these people fulfill their dreams. And when I read that part that he said to Laura Ingraham, I got defensive about it. That it was just like, wait a second. America doesn't have talented people, is what you're saying? And you know, this is extraordinary to hear from Trump. But I was kind of offended.
Well, I took the same as Marge was describing, that you're like, did I miss? Is this just a clip taken out of context? Did I miss the context? Did I miss the prelude? Did I miss?
Yeah. This is
the footnote. What it was odd.
This is the aha moment for a lot of people in MAGA land who now understand what we all have understood, which is that Trump, for all his life, has been a lot of things. But most of all, he's a chameleon. In a lot of ways, and I think what's happened is the chameleon kind of has lost his ability to change, and now he's in the position of having to defend where he is and what he is and what his policies are and everything else, and now he's in this position where he's going to start saying things like this, I think, more and more.
I want to show off. We're going to take a break.
Wow.
We'll be right back right after this.
You're on it.
Republican strategist Steve Cortez, who has argued that the U.S. admits too many foreign workers and foreign students, says if you don't show them that you're not standing up for them on these populist nationalist issues, I think there's a real risk for the 2026 midterms. I don't know anyone on the right who's so angry that they're splitting with Donald Trump, but we're disappointed and we want to lead him to a better place. Anyone have an idea of how you do that?
You know,
gold stickies from Home Depot might do it.
Before this election, before this presidency, I would have said you lead him along by showing him where his strength lies, where populism lies, and what the right things to say are. Because the one thing that is apparent about him now, and a lot of MAGA people are, coming to terms with it, or realizing it anyway, and maybe not coming to terms with it, is that he is the consummate politician, who the person you say, you describe as, they will say and do anything it takes to get elected. So he would have, before this election, you could have easily led Trump. Now he is in this place where I think even he knows it's his last term. He stands to be potentially a lame duck after the next congressional election, and you're not going to lead him anywhere. But to say that is to miss, I think, the dynamics of where we are now, which is exactly what I said, that he is at the end of his political life, and he's not going to be led anywhere. Now he's just going to. He's going to give us Trump. And there'll be people, you know, who ultimately shrug their shoulders, I think, when you say, you know, this is going to pass, who ultimately shrug their shoulders and say, well, it's Trump being Trump again. He's telling it like it is. I guess we have to accept that.
Well, I have this thing, like, it's a, you know, it's a really old, and this isn't a, I'm not slighting Trump's age, but it's just like it's the aging 70s or 80s band where you're like, yeah, I know, they're not as good as they used to be, but let's just go and listen to the hits. Like, right?
Who I mean, are you talking about Bon Jovi or Supertramp?
Ooh, sounds like fighting words.
Yeah. No. But it just seems to me that the people, like, they like hearing that stuff, like, mm-hmm. hear his greatest hits.
Right.
And even if it's not based in real reality, then that doesn't matter.
But if they start to feel that he's insincere, then we're at, in a very short span of time, we're at the Reagan betrayal.
Yeah.
You know, that Ronald Reagan ultimately, for all, he was still being remembered fondly as the greatest conservative ever in well into the 90s, but there were other people in the right, on the far right, you know, screaming on right-wing radio about how they were betrayed, particularly on immigration, by Reagan's promises, and then he, you know, just, you know, basically gave it, you know, it was basically an amnesty for everybody in exchange for a promise that the borders were going to be sealed tight, and they weren't. So never trust Republicans again. And then here Trump comes along, and everybody says, oh, we'll trust him.
And we are starting to see those right-wing voices, like I was just saying, that I had seen on Twitter and in the videos where people are questioning him. And I think it does open the door and give license to people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and others, Massey from Kentucky, to start, you know, really rattling the cages and disagreeing. Disagreeing with Trump has to become okay for Republicans. That's the place we need to go to, right? Yeah. They have to be able to question him and to push back.
But he's had I totally agree with Jay and March, the both of you. He's had a pretty phenomenal run in the second term,
yep.
Right? So the question for me is his confidence even remotely shaken by this moment? My guess is the answer is no, right? Epstein, I think, is a slightly bigger issue for him. But I don't think the interview with Laura Ingraham is going to shake his confidence, because I actually think he's just sort of shooting from the hip in that moment, right? He's we're applying a standard of rationality on Trump that he has never shown to be rational in these moments. He's shown to be autocratic and all-powerful. And so I think it's a mistake for us to think that there was some rational moment in there. And that said, he still is the, you know, flag bearer for the GOP. And as long as he's a flag bearer for the GOP, I think he's going to maintain the same level of confidence.
He's always benefited from other people, having other people around him, either paid to clean up that misstatement or... or willing to do it, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Elise Stefanik and the Speaker of the House. I don't know why his name.
Mike Johnson?
Yes, I
keep losing his name all week. You know, when those people aren't cleaning up for him, that's a bad sign for him. That's when he may have his uh-oh moment, maybe. Or he'll lash out.
I think the next uh-oh moment for him is when Democrats win 35 additional seats at the midterm, and I think it's probably going to be around between 30 and 40. I think that's the uh-oh moment for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that he thinks he's untouchable, like you said, and I think he also thinks he has the ability to spin this. You know, there's no president that really has been more pro-America, not America, because, you know, but pro MAGA, you know, than him. And I think that he will point to the changes that he has made in immigration, you know, in the like lower income immigrants that he has managed to remove, and say, hey, find another president that's willing to take a greater stand on this issue that you care deeply about. And if this is your priority, if this is what you're voting on, nobody's going to do more than me. You just have to let me get away with some small things that you might not agree on.
I was surprised that there wasn't conversation about how, if you really feel that we don't have the talent here, you know, cutting the Department of Education and clawing back millions of dollars of research money from universities might not be the way to go. And I just haven't seen that conversation happening. And I was kind of surprised. I thought there would be people writing about that, but that didn't seem to
be. We want
to
get more $100,000 visa applications. Yeah. And so let's just cut all of the education so we have to import everybody.
All right, couple letters, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back for more letters. Let's see. We begin with Vincent. Trump's understanding of what has truly made America great is practically non-existent, i.e. science and research, world-class higher education, a nonpartisan professional military, immigrants bringing myriad skills. It's no surprise that his recent talent comment is equally ignorant. That from Vincent. We go to Suzanne. I think Bo is exactly right. The writing is on the wall that Trump is not long for this world, and everyone wants to be the one who inherits his base, while Vance has the best position right now. It's very clear that no one likes him, and he lacks the charisma to keep MAGA together. The disagreement between the administration and the base over the Epstein files is the most obvious lever to shift the balance of power as soon as Trump is out of the picture. MTG sees that. Others, like rats from a sinking ship, will follow other political flotsam or commit themselves to her raft until they see an opportunity to shove her off. Interesting times. Well, you certainly painted a picture, Suzanne. That's good. Then we check in with John. When Trump says that he's never heard of affordability, I believe him. It's in a group with compassion and constitutionality and logic, you know, words that he just does not seem to be all that familiar with. Thank you, John. Then we go to Frank. I believe that Marjorie Taylor Greene is, quote, moderating her public persona because she's positioning herself to run for the Senate. That from Frank. Then we go to this letter from also about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm curious to hear how you see Marjorie Taylor Greene has changed. Perhaps she is breaking away from Trump. Well, that's what we've been we've been talking about. And I think, you know, as it suits, right?
Yeah. And the question, that kind of runs through that entire discussion is, is the MAGA universe going to perceive her as opportunistic, or are they going to see her as sincere? Is she truly a populist who is now sounding rational, or is she just a populist who's trying to sound rational so she can get ahead, and she's betraying them along the way?
Yeah. And the other thing is that I find so fascinating is the fact that if you are on the tail end, the margins of the party, as Marjorie Taylor Greene has historically been, right? Maybe she's moving a little bit towards the middle. If you're on the tail end of that, AOC on the other side, you get a disproportionate amount of press coverage, right?
Yes.
There is no Marjorie Taylor Greene is one of 435 members of Congress. And so why aren't we paying attention to those in the middle who are the more rational figures? And in fact, if American politics has become a tail marginal extreme right and left politics, we're in more trouble than just one autocratic president.
Let's take a break. When we return, we'll continue, move on to other topics. We welcome you, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome you as always. And one more letter and then we'll go to a new topic. John says, let's just say the quiet part out loud. These visas are for bringing in white people. ICE is for rounding up people of color and sending them to gulags. America First has always been whites first. That's always been the real point, and the reaction of MAGA is starting to show that.
But I think what you're going to see is what Trump is talking about, other than, well, even the $100,000 charge and stuff. We're talking about people who are coming from, South Asian places in a lot of cases. They are not white people. Trump is real. I think that's where people are really, the MAGA world is bristling. I just wanted to touch on one thing that Bo said. I think it was actually on the break. So, but it all becomes a blur after
it really does.
45 minutes.
Yeah.
The part about Marjorie Taylor Greene, why she's news. She's, and you know, it's sad that she is, but the reality is that a centrist politician saying something intelligent and sensible and moderate is a dog bites man story. A person who talks about space lasers suddenly sounding reasonable is a man bites dog story. And that's, you know, unfortunately, that's news, for better or worse.
Let's see. We go to Anderson, who says, I think the panel has fallen into the same trap that the left has fallen into the entire time that Trump has come into and held on to power, which is that we all hope that everyone sees the stupidity that we see and then he will fall flat on his face. But the reality is that he has allowed the right to enact policies that they've wanted to enact for 20 years, and so no matter the amount of circus antics that occur at the top, he is a useful tool to ram them through far-right policies. And I think that instead of laughing at his antics, we should all be thinking about how we start to build the country we want to live in instead of just waiting for him to slowly fade and hoping that Marjorie Taylor Greene doesn't take his place.
I think that's right.
I would argue that the second part of that is what we've been doing. But
right.
Yes, yeah.
No, I think that's right. I think one of the problems that I've repeatedly said on this show is the Democrats need to figure out how to rebuild their coalition and come up, as March and I were talking about, come up with a message that resonates in the same way that the GOP has mastered that part of politics. And until we do that, until the Democrats do that, Anderson is correct.
A little context from Dave, who says, I've read opinions that because Trump did not support Marjorie Taylor Greene and her bid in Georgia, she is her Senate bid in Georgia, she is basically doing her own payback tour of him for a little bit.
Well, that frees her up. You know, right. We need more of that, honestly, you know, where people can speak their minds.
All right. Let's go to we will go to aspects of the Epstein story here. And as I said, these stories do merge a little bit because of the MAGA fallout and what the position of those in the Republican Party and MAGA are saying about the president and what's happening in regards to Jeffrey Epstein. In September, when Democrats were threatening to jam up Congress by forcing votes on releasing the Epstein files, House GOP leaders devised a strategy to insulate themselves and deliver on Trump's demand to shut the issue down. Rather than facing a vote many Republicans desperately wanted to avoid on whether the file should come out, they would pass a measure that directed the House Oversight Committee to continue an investigation into the Epstein case that it had been conducting for weeks. The move was entirely symbolic. No vote was needed to allow the Republican-led committee to keep up the work that it had begun in July. Democrats had managed to force the chairman to issue a subpoena to the Justice Department for information about its inquiry into the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. But the maneuver offered Republicans a chance to show their constituents, many of whom were livid after the Trump administration closed its Epstein investigation without releasing the revelations that top officials had promised, that their representatives in Congress were committed to transparency. The committee's investigation was meant to give the GOP some political cover while holding off a rising tide of pressure on the administration to reveal more about its investigation into Mr. Epstein, who died in prison in 2019. Yet, if the panel's investigation was aimed at easing political pressure on Republicans and Mr. Trump, it appears to have had the opposite effect. The Republican-led committee has, almost in spite of itself, produced a number of striking revelations that have intensified the drumbeat of demands for more transparency and kept attention on Mr. Trump's past ties to Mr. Epstein. In doing so, the panel has helped to box Speaker Mike Johnson into scheduling the vote he has long avoided, now expected next week, on whether to demand that the Justice Department quickly release all of its Epstein files. That from the New York Times. I will say that that was four paragraphs perfectly summarized in the headline for this article. Republicans tried to squelch the Epstein Fuhrer. Instead, they fed it.
Mm-hmm. Jay. And part of that, I think the story got into was the idea that putting out the 20,000 emails was kind of theatrical after the three that came out that were really troubling, and so what you do is you flood the discussion with a whole bunch of irrelevant stuff, and you say, oh, look, you just cherry picked those three. And that's like saying that, you know, we had this wiretap on a mob boss, and you know, he talked about his mom, he talked about the price of cement, he talked about his gout, he talked about this. Oh yeah, he talked about where they buried Jimmy Hoffa. But you know, let's not cherry pick just that. I mean, that's, you know, I won't say that it was quite that incriminating. But the, you know, the central takeaway from the three emails that were released, and we'll see what, you know, some of those other 20,000 said, is that there's a strong indication, I think more than an indication, that Trump knew, and Epstein was clear about that he knew about what he was doing. He knew that he was doing a lot with young girls. And, you know, you're not going to get away from that. And that's what, you know, I think that the House is trying to figure out a way out of it. I don't think they're going to find a way out of it.
Footnote to that, just to add some context, you don't even need the mob boss story. Watergate was that example. There are hundreds and hundreds of hours exactly. of conversation that Nixon's having in the Oval Office. And are we cherry picking the ones where he's covering up the
the worst?
It seems a little absurd.
Yeah. Mark?
You know, I didn't realize how much this shutdown was a plug in the dike of Epstein. I really didn't realize how it was jamming everything up. I mean, I knew that they wanted the votes on the discharge position, but I thought we were going to have to wait for that petition to make it through the process to see more material. I didn't realize that, like, the second they got back, there would be release of materials. And I think that the release of the 20,000 pages in response, it was a desperation move because— You guys, we have AI, we have Control F, you know, to be able to search a document very quickly for a word. And those 20,000 pages are being reviewed by, you know, thousands and thousands of people. And there's other things in there that I think people are nervous about, that Trump is nervous about. You know, there are other references in there. I was really disheartened to see that Megyn Kelly was kind of almost justifying, you know, this sexual abuse of young women by saying that, you know, they weren't prepubescent. I mean, it was really, you're starting to see sort of a conversation that is offering a sick justification based on the age of the women who were, you know, the girls, I should say, who were abused here. And I think that's going to further divide people and the MAGA universe. Yeah.
Anna. I think that this is definitely good for Democrats. I think that this is going to push the House to vote on this. And then we will have concrete who voted yes, who voted no. And in 2026, people will be able to run against their opponent saying, hey, they were trying to cover up Epstein. They're also pushing the health care vote. They're going to be able to say, hey, these people wanted your health care costs to double, triple. I think that that's kind of our only strategy at this point with the Democrats is to differentiate ourselves by having like really concrete examples of when the Republicans are failing their constituents. I don't think it's in terms of actually getting these files released. I don't think that this is going to do anything. You know, the House is gonna might vote to release the files, but the Senate surely isn't, and Trump would definitely veto it even if it came to him. So I don't know if we'll necessarily see more, but just with the release of this information, we have so much more concrete evidence to tie Trump to Epstein, and perhaps that's all we need.
Yeah, and that's great. I totally agree. What's interesting, Anna, is a week ago, the vote in the House of Representatives would, I'm going to guess, would have been relatively close. Now, because of the need for, to be reelected and so on, I don't think the vote is close anymore. And so the question becomes, if it's overwhelmingly in support of releasing, the question becomes, how much can Democrats use that as leverage for people to say one way or the other? Because I think there's just going to be a unified House and it's going to go nowhere. The other thing that's interesting, and I'll admit, last thing I'll say on this one is I'll admit to my own political naivete. I was in class yesterday and I'm ranting about the Trump administration generally, not really ranting because I have to maintain some decorum in front of 18 to 22 year olds. But the reality was I was sitting there talking about the fact that they're
okay.
At least pretend. I'm sitting there and I'm saying I'm going over the long list of things that are, in my opinion, from 2016, disqualifiers for Trump as president of the United States. And there's a lot of them, right? And I said, right at the end of class, I said, how is it possible that the Epstein files is the thing that's ultimately going to sink him when he's done all of these other things from not just harassing, but abusing women all the way through to this sort of stuff? And a student sort of had a drop the mic moment, raised his hand and said, people don't like pedophiles. And the reality is that's it. That's what makes this different.
Which is where Megyn Kelly is going with this. Right. I joked about it. I half joked about it on Facebook that we're about to learn. We're about to be parsing the difference between a pedophile and I'm going to mangle this word, ephebophile, which is the 12 to 14 or 12 to 16 12 to 15 range. And Megyn Kelly went there.
Gross. I don't want to be parsing that. Yeah. I don't.
But that's exactly what Megyn Kelly did. Yeah. She said, we're talking about barely legal. No, we're not talking about barely legal. We're talking about barely illegal.
Right.
And that's the other side of the 16-year-old line in a lot of states.
I'm going to sort of throw a grenade in here just before we go to a break. But, you know, to what you were saying, Bo, about of this back and forth of the politics of it and what the Democrats can do and so forth. I mean, I would be surprised if there are not a lot of key Democrats that are included in all of this as well.
I agree.
And how is that going to be played? Right. Because it certainly can be.
That's why running a younger bench is so important right now, because I can tell you what, Mam Dami did not go to Epstein Island. And neither did the new
right.
Seattle
it's
mayor.
So true.
Or Mickey Sherrill, you know what I'm saying? So
he was also seven at the time, but but hopefully
and
he wouldn't
wrong
anyway.
With that? That's right. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue much more to discuss. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. .org. We'll take a break and then we'll go to news with David Castillo. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is Friday, the 14th of November, and 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. We welcome you and your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I just want to get to two Epstein file letters and then go to another aspect of this story, which I want to hear everybody on, but especially Jay. So we begin with Dan, who says, yes, some released emails with nothing but innuendo. Meanwhile, the DOJ can simply destroy any incriminating evidence on Trump, donors, operatives, associates, etc. There will be nothing incriminating about Trump, etc. When the files finally are released, it'll be seen as just another giant hoax by his advocates. Democrats will likely have egg on their face once again. Then we go to Cynthia. Somehow, it does not seem at all surprising that this most tawdry, cringe-inducing story should be the one that dogs Trump to an ignominious fade from the stage, not with a bang, but with a whimper. hoist on his own petard as his own team used the Epstein saga as campaign fodder. Talk about the banality of evil. That from Cynthia.
You know, just going back to the destruction of evidence, I don't know where that, how valid that is or how invalid it is. You know, on the one hand, Trump pardoned all, you know, I think the signal of pardoning all the January 6 people was a signal to everybody who would break the law on his behalf that I will, you have me. You have my unequivocal, unconditional, unchallengeable pardon power. On the other hand, it only goes so far. If you destroy evidence as a lawyer, which is most of the people in the Department of Justice, the Bar Association is going to get you, as they proved with, I think, Giuliani, and they proved with Sidney Powell. I think she was disbarred. You know, you might do okay for a little while, but unless you're, you know, telegenic and hope to get a spot on Fox someday as a consultant, your career is finished. So
both of whom got a pardon.
Yep. But they'll never work in law again. But he gets to keep his Super Bowl rings or whatever they were, World Series rings. And both and an apartment in New York and a condo in Florida.
Wow. So the final aspect of the Epstein story that I would like to talk about, which I don't think we've brought up really at all during this discussion, although it's been something that I've been absolutely fascinated with since the emails came out, and that is Michael Wolff. Mm. Oh my goodness! So Michael Wolff is a journalist, a writer. Let's say a writer. Who features prominently in newly released Jeffrey Epstein emails and has achieved extraordinary access but faced questions about his journalistic ethics. Now, early on in the administration, Michael Wolff, this is in the first Trump administration, I think maybe 2 years in, he wrote a book called Fire and Fury. And it was one of those books that was here's the inside scoop. Really, it would be something that you would expect from Bob Woodward, only not fact checked, right? And so it seemed like, but there was a lot of gossip in there and so forth. Well, now you basically have these emails that come out that have Michael Wolff exchanging emails with Jeffrey Epstein and basically saying, heads up, if you want to be in on this takedown, I could really use you, and let's go.
Right.
Or if you want to help protect him, let me know what you got. And they go back from December 15th, 2015. And one of the emails that said heads up, Wolf warned Epstein that later in the day at a televised debate for the Republican presidential primary, Donald Trump was likely to be quizzed about his year-long social relationship with Epstein. By then, Epstein had pleaded guilty in Florida to solicitation of prostitution with a minor, though Trump has always claimed they had fallen out years earlier. Their association remained, as it still does today, politically problematic for him. Epstein responded to Wolf's alert by asking for personal advice. If we were able to craft an answer for him, what do you think it should be? He wrote. Wolf replied, I think you should let him hang himself, which is cringeworthy considering, if he says he hasn't been on the plane or to the house, then that gives you a valuable PR and political currency. You can hang him in a way that potentially generates a positive benefit for you, or if it really looks like he could win, you could save him generating a debt. Wow.
This is going to sound like an irrelevant anecdote, but a long time ago, when they were building the Arbor Hill police station on Henry Johnson Boulevard. The city manager, he wasn't the city manager. We don't have a city manager. The assistant to the mayor, Phil Calderon, called me up and said, could you come over and take a look at this? And I was like, I wanted to do a story on the place anyway. And so I went over and he said, and we stood on the side of the building, the Henry Johnson side of the building. And he said, what do you think of this? And I felt kind of uncomfortable even answering the question. It's not my, now I might write a story about what I think about it, but this felt weird. So, but I looked at it and I said, I got to be honest, it looks like a fortress. Those windows are really small. And he goes, I thought so too. And he went in the building and the next thing I knew, they ripped the windows out and they did. That has haunted me for years, that I always felt like I overstepped something as a journalist by giving him my, and I was a news reporter then, I wasn't an editorial writer, and I felt like somehow I had had an influence on city policy that I should not have had. It was a little tiny thing, but
I was going to say, that doesn't rise to
this
level. This
is not this. But when I read the
sleep easy.
Absolutely,
Jay,
absolutely. But what I'm saying is that a journalist, that's how journalists are.
Sure.
That we have that thought process going on. Now, if all Michael Wolff was doing, if Michael Wolff had said in that email, what do you got on him, is that would be a whole other thing. That would be a legitimate give and take in a conversation between a reporter and a source, so the reporter can find out, what do you got on a president, on a leading presidential candidate? I'd like to know. But that's not what he did. He was giving him political, criminal defense, PR advice. It was so unethical. And reading that story was just, it was extraordinary. Originally, I was like, do I really care about this? This is guy, this felt like reading Hollywood Review or so, but then I got into it and I read it from beginning to end. It was fascinating.
The fire and fury.
How corrupt this guy is.
Yeah, yeah.
And the contrast between Michael Wolff and Jay Jacquinus is pretty stark. So that's real. But I'll say a couple of things, and at the risk of throwing every possible cliche, statement, aphorism, metaphor out there, Madison said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. Power is corrupting, and it's a, for lack of a better term in this particular context, it's an aphrodisiac. And Michael Wolff is going to bury his integrity, shame on him, because he has Epstein gave people power. And so if I'm Michael Wolff, I'm thinking one thing. And if I'm Larry Summers, right, there was a time when Larry Summers was a major figure in the Democratic Party after post-Harvard. When he was Secretary of the Treasury, he too has to sort of grapple with this sort of stuff. And the last thing I'll say, which is super, I think it's super interesting about this, is I'm going to guess that Larry Summers will continue to be on TV, despite the fact that these things have come out about him and, how Epstein was consulting or advising him about how to do particular things. I'm going to guess that he stayed on TV in the same way that Jeffrey Toobin stays on TV. And I'm all about giving people second chances. But there was a time in our collective lives where you didn't get a second chance in public media. And those days apparently are over.
Yeah.
I'm going to play devil's advocate. What's the big deal? Look, he has this MO where he cozies up to people. He's gotten close to Rupert Murdoch, Steve Bannon, Trump. And we've learned some interesting things from those conversations. And, he himself is not saying that he holds himself to these journalistic standards. We're in this age where, standards don't matter, apparently. So, I'm going to just push back and say, so he was engaged in a way that you wouldn't be comfortable with, but maybe we learned something from it. Yeah.
But when all the people around him who know his MO are saying that he's not really so much worried about the truth as the bigger truth that he thinks is there, that's troubling. That's not supposed to be what people consume and print and consider legitimate. I mean, there's plenty of tabloid stuff out there and plenty of nonsense out there that is not true. But this is presented by his publisher as truth.
as an auditor, I want to have standards. We have something we call criteria. That's what we, you know, the standard that we audit to, right? Did you actually meet the terms of the contract, or are you actually obeying the law? But right now we have a president who's making billions of dollars off crypto for his family. So I'm like, I don't know. Do rules matter?
Fair enough.
I mean, yeah, it just shocks me that anybody continues to talk to this man. The fact that Murdoch and Bannon, like Bannon continues to talk to him, even though he's been completely burned in the past by books that he put out and essentially got him exiled from Trump previously. And now he's, you know, so it doesn't make any sense. Nobody should talk to this person ever again. This should be the nail in the coffin, but here we are.
Probably one of the arts of journalism, right? Yeah. Is getting people to talk to you.
People want to talk to him.
When they know better.
Yeah.
They know better, and they still talk to you.
Well, and that's one of those Trump things, too, where he'll blast somebody for, I think of Bob Woodward when I talk about this, of being burned and saying, you know, he's low level, know nothing, and then the next book, he's there talking to him again. And you have all the recordings and the tapes and everything else. I did think when you were talking about Larry Summers, though, it, just in this week we heard, going back to the Social Network movie, both Larry Summers and the Winklevoss twins being in the news this week. So that's that. I think that
a good week,
or as they say in Social Network, Winklevi. They're part of this. If you haven't read this story, Mark Whitman and I have been talking about discussing this on the show. But the story in the Financial Times about the Trump money and the crypto,
yeah,
is unbelievable.
Crazy.
I mean, it's stunning. All right. Let us. Where are we? Okay. So. That when I asked that question, I meant where are we time wise. So just so you know that I actually am aware of where
Albany, New York.
I am physically. I know that much, although that may not be completely clear at this moment. So let's talk about redistricting in the state of California, and what is happening with the DOJ. The Justice Department is suing to block a California congressional map that favors the Democrats. Now, California voters approved the new map, a counterpunch to Trump-backed redistricting in Texas and other red states via a ballot measure this week. But now, the Justice Department on Thursday joined a lawsuit seeking to block California's new congressional map, the latest chapter in a nationwide redistricting battle sparked by President Donald Trump's push for red states to add more Republican-leaning districts ahead of next year's midterm elections. California's new congressional map was implemented via ballot measure during the November 4th election, gaining the approval of nearly 65% of California voters. The measure allows Governor Gavin Newsom to circumvent the state's nonpartisan redistricting commission to redraw the map for three elections, but returns redistricting authority to the commission after the 2030 census. But wait, there's more. Newsom should be concerned about keeping Californians safe and shutting down Antifa violence, not rigging his state for political gain. That is the quote from Attorney General Pam Bondi on X. The Justice Department is joining a suit filed in federal court this month by the California Assembly member, Republican, who alleged in his filing that the new congressional map, which adds five more Democratic-leaning districts, violates the 14th and the 15th Amendments and the protections against racial gerrymandering. If only we had someone to tell us about the 14th and 15th Amendments, Bo.
Yeah, that's right. I will always say whenever I get the window of opportunity, the 14th Amendment is the game changer in the Constitution. It's the most important and most influential one. That said, this is a if there are listeners out there who are still not cynical about American politics, this is the moment.
For God's sakes, wise up and be cynical. Right.
This is the moment because ultimately there's a lot of things going on here. So the Supreme Court in the last, it really has been since 2019. They've had two really important cases since 2019 about redistricting. One is Rucho versus Common Cause, in which the court essentially said we're going to get out of the game of determining whether or not gerrymandering is fair. We'll leave it to the states. And they're talking about partisan gerrymandering. Now, Roberts was careful to say that when there's race-based gerrymandering, the court will still stay in the game. And that's what happened in 2023 in South Carolina when the six majority, when South Carolina, the South Carolina NAACP argued that there was unfair white racial gerrymandering by the South Carolina state legislature. And Alito wrote an opinion for the six conservative justices that said, oh, no, it's not racial gerrymandering in South Carolina. It's just straight ahead partisan gerrymandering, which has been happening forever. Right. So it's in this context that Pam Bondi is joining this litigation, 14th Amendment equal protection litigation, to say that the California gerrymandering process is race-based gerrymandering and you can't do that. So, but the cynical part of it is let's juxtapose that with Texas, right? So the crazy part is that there was a trial in Texas in which the state argued that lines were drawn based on race-based gerrymandering, and that the state, there was a race-based gerrymandering case prior to Trump getting involved in it. And the state was convinced that it wasn't race-based gerrymandering, right? So the Trump administration then pressed Governor Abbott to find more Republican districts, right? And the DOJ said that race must have played a role in the early 2020 race-based gerrymandering. And so what happened was Abbott pivots on a dime and says, oh, yeah, we're talking about race-based gerrymandering, and I'm going to take over the gerrymandering process. So what happened was when Trump got involved, Texas sort of released their argument in the trial and took the opposite view in order to get the outcome that they want, five additional red seats. So my point, my bigger point, there's a lot of information there. My bigger point here is that at the end of the day, not only is it that mid-census gerrymandering is just antithetical to the way in which American politics has worked, but now these governors in particular, but also state legislatures in red and blue states, are trying to manipulate it in such a way, and the DOJ is all about sort of getting in there to make it difficult for California to do what it wants to do. It's a mess, and it's utterly politics, and it's shameful.
I think it's I think it's beyond shameful. I think it's dangerous. You know, forgetting about I'd be accused of whataboutism when I say this, but you know, it underlies everything you said. I think that why aren't you going after Texas? Why aren't you going after Ohio and Kansas and Missouri and you know, on and on? The politics of this is so blatant that the Justice Department, you know, you want to talk about a weaponized justice system, they are going only after Democrats on this and trying to help the president achieve, a perpetual Republican majority, at least in his term. And, you know, to go back to the Supreme Court, I get what the Supreme Court is saying, that this is a political fight. We are, you know, not in that. But it's at some point, and I suspect in the next generation, if not sooner, the Supreme Court is going to realize that this is not just a political fight, that the ability to redistrict with such surgical precision that you can basically subvert the entire democratic process and make it moot. is a danger to the Constitution. It's a danger to the Republic. It's a danger to our freedom, and that what the Justice Department is doing is the perfect example of it. It is a regime trying to manipulate only one side of the equation. This is as close as we're getting to losing democracy, I think.
And the fact that it's done on a state-by-state basis is just crazy. There needs to be some sort of federal standard, because otherwise it's just a race to the bottom. Mm-hmm. And each state does it differently. And like California had to vote on it. They had to get people, everyday people to vote on it. And that's one protection that a lot of the Democratic states have put into place. Whereas Republican states like Texas, it's just the lawmakers. And they're like, oh, well, we're a Republican run state. Would we like to have more Republicans running things? Well, yes, I would like that.
20 seconds. Go ahead.
You know, I think that we need to be thinking about this from a federal level. Otherwise, we're just going to keep having this happen.
We'll take a break. We'll finish up our last half hour when we come back. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Bo Breslin, March Gallagher, Anna Markowitz, and Jay Jochnowitz on the program this morning, making up our Friday panel. We have about another 25 minutes or so together, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Anything you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We were talking about the issue of Michael Wolff. And was there anything else that anybody wanted to say on that before we move on?
No, but I just remembered something when you said panel at WAMC.
No, we were talking about redistricting. My apologies. Gerrymandering, yes. Go ahead.
When you said panel at WAMC.org yesterday,
yes.
Totally off topic, you brought up the coffee table book. That Sarah Boynton's son did.
Yeah.
And it had the holidays of the year. And somebody and the panelists were talking about wanting to know what is in a pirate cocktail.
Yes.
And it's a simple thing. It's rum.
Yeah. There you go. It's got to be rum.
I was in my car, right. And I'm like, I've got to find the thing. And I'm driving. As I'm trying to type in panel at WAMC, I said, okay, this is not that important.
Rum.
You can say it on the air on Friday.
Correct it.
Okay.
All right. Anyone else
on
redistricting? Of course.
I'd like to get my two cents in.
Of course.
I'm relieved that New York cannot do this without a constitutional amendment. And the soonest we could get it on the ballot is 27, because I think it would absolutely rip the state apart. I know that California was able to rally and it got 65% of the vote. I don't think that would happen here. And I think it would be incredibly damaging to the governor's race that we're going to be seeing next year if this was out there as something to be voted on in 26. So I'm relieved that it's delayed, at least for now. And I also just think we're moving to a place nationally where we're saying that protecting racial minorities is illegitimate as an act. And that in and of itself, any action that protects minorities is racist. And I think that's undermining really equal protection and so many parts of our Constitution and so many of the rights that we enjoy as Americans. It's terrifying to have the conversation reversed. It's sort of a gaslighting approach to addressing race in the country. And I'm really scared about it. Not just the redistricting, but this set of arguments that's going around it. Yeah.
And it also, I'll throw this in, March, and add this to what I think is exactly right. The importance of the judiciary in this moment becomes even more escalated, right? So remember, throughout the, I will always seize an opportunity to talk about things like Brown versus Board of Education. The NAACP used the judiciary because it could not use elected officials to advance the agenda, move the needle on racial minorities in this country. As the courts are embroiled in gerrymandering and other ways where we're eliminating the one person, one vote mentality, that the judiciary becomes even more important.
Where does it end, though? I mean, if we keep changing the rules and we keep changing whatever the whatever state we're talking about, and the numbers change, the legislature changes, the governorship changes, and I mean, we could be playing this till the cows come home.
Yeah. So where does it end? I mean, in the ideal world and not the realistic world, it ends in your hometown of Philadelphia. Because the Constitution, as much as I revere it, is broken. Mm-hmm. And Anna said it right. If there's a way in which you can make gerrymandering federal, that's a constitutional amendment, then at least that one area is taken. It's easy. And the gerrymandering, nonpartisan commissions work in places. Make it at the federal level. Do the 28th Amendment, you're good to go. There's a lot more that we have to change in the Constitution, but the problem is, Joe, we don't have the appetite to change the Constitution, I think, in our lifetime, and that's a real problem.
I don't see how we survive this as a democracy without some changes to the Constitution.
Agreed.
Really. I mean, there are so many issues, from the Electoral College to the size of the Supreme Court to, right, you know, these issues on gerrymandering. I mean, I just think we're going to have to stomach some approach to these issues at a constitutional level.
Public financing of elections, yes, is another one.
Yes,
I think,
yes,
you could sell the American people on it, too. If you can convince people in Texas that New York is a gerrymandering state, you know, if you pass sensible election reform at the federal level, put it into the Constitution, you could stop California from doing that. And you,
agreed,
could tell the people in California, you could stop Texas from doing this. If we could all get back to a level playing field, we can have an honest discussion. There's a lot of people in this country that know that a level playing field is not going to favor the Republicans.
That's one of the beauties of the California Action, is that it really shows, like, oh, you're going to do this, we're going to do this too.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, you know, as much as I can't stomach the idea that we're gerrymandering just for this purpose, but
also, and I mean, we just saw this in the panel a moment ago, but 64% of the people,
65.
I mean,
two-thirds.
That says a lot.
It's a lot.
You know, that are like, yeah, let's do this. I mean,
right,
you mentioned your class. Like,
right,
yeah, let's do it.
But the other thing that's interesting about this, that that doesn't get as much airplay, it gets some in the press, it doesn't get as much airplay. Gavin Newsom doubled down. This was his signature moment, and he killed it, right? He,
yep,
knocked it out of the park. And so the odds of him becoming the Democratic nominee skyrocketed, mm-hmm, as a result of what is a political maneuver that's actually pretty hard to swallow.
Yeah, it's bad policy, but
right,
it's good politics.
Right. Mm.
And that's, you know, so he'd be a perfect person. It would be a perfect campaign platform for him to run on a constitutional amendment. He said, you know, he could say, I know what gerrymandering
that's
is.
Right.
I think we need to get rid of it. We did it to save this republic. I'm going to save it if you send me to Washington. I mean, that's a pretty – I'm not doing a Michael Wolff, by the way.
No, I understand.
I just want to be really clear.
I understand.
But the one danger is that talking about constitutional amendments just opens it up to the Mark Levins of the world and stuff, who want a constitutional convention.
Yeah.
And they want to put the whole thing up for debate.
Right.
And in this day and age, I don't think you want to do that.
It sounds more dangerous than it might be worth.
Yeah. But a focused amendments to fix the problems that we're seeing, like the pardon power, things like that, one at a time, I could see doing that.
Could we get the ERA done? Just asking, you know, please.
Supposedly it was done, and nobody seems to want to fight that battle in court.
Dave writes, one of your panelists earlier today lamented that no one is writing about the horrors of the Trump administration. I don't recall that being said, but I will go on with the letter, and maybe it will rattle something to remember this. Dave says that is not true. Many people in newspapers and magazines are, in fact, writing about them in great detail. Now is anyone reading those articles? Don't be silly. Until Fox News, Newsmax, and others start reporting on Trump accurately, you can wring your hands all you want, and it is all for naught.
I don't think that's
true. I don't think that's true.
Maybe the writer is referring back to us talking about how right-wing media is kind of beginning to sort of poke back at Trump.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I don't think that I don't think that's true. I mean, I think the well, I'll just leave it at that. Get to another writer.
let's just keep it. All right, let's go on to a let's go to a different topic. I want to talk about Texas A&M, and I was not aware all this was going on at Texas A&M. I mean I knew, but I didn't know that this was going on.
I mean, another reason not to move to Texas.
happening at universities all over, but I found this story to be really interesting. Texas A&M University System Regents voted Thursday to limit how instructors may discuss matters like gender identity and race ideology in classrooms, tightening the rules in a conservative state where debates over academic freedom have flared for months. Regents, who met in College Station on Thursday afternoon, unanimously backed a revised proposal decreeing that no courses, quote, will advocate race or gender ideology or topics related to sexual orientation or gender identity, unquote, without a campus president's approval of the course and the related materials. A related measure that Regents approved said that faculty members could not, quote, teach material that is inconsistent with the approved syllabus for the course. You know, the Bible. Taken together, the policies represent an effort by Texas A&M system leaders to assert firmer control over classrooms at a time when Republican officials in the state have been accusing public universities of indoctrinating students with liberal ideas about race and gender, a movement that has unfolded in parallel to President Trump's campaign to pressure elite schools. Professors have fired back. The conservative politicians are seeking to stifle open debates and intellectual inquiry. And Bo, like, not only stifling open debates and intellectual inquiry, but just reality.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I think that I'll start by saying, you know, whoa, the hypocrisy here, right? Where somehow the idea, remember, when Trump was going after these elite institutions, and he still is, the idea was that somehow there was not enough representation of conservative views on campus. And so now we're going to shut down liberal views on campus. So the hypocrisy is shocking. And you know, I'm struck, Joe, by a couple of things about A&M. First of all, this is the top of the heap when it comes to damage to an institution. If you're talking curricular reform or curricular, you know, curricular damage here, the reality is when a state gets involved in what can be taught and how it can be taught, that's different than a state getting involved in the removal of the president like at UVA. This is the top of the heap, and this is the most problematic thing from a higher education perspective. And quite frankly, from a liberal, as in small L liberal, not large L Democrat, but liberal, the freeing of the mind is what we're trying to educate these 18 to 22-year-olds. And you cannot free the mind if you cut off at one side of the argument. I, too, spend a decent amount of time in my class talking about the conservative perspective because I think it's important that students understand that. And I'll say one more thing because it reminds me of Chris Murphy, right, the great senator from Connecticut. It reminds me of Chris Murphy, who said, make sure that when we're talking about voting, make sure you're paying attention to all the small ways that political parties are chipping away at voting. The same is true at higher ed. So 135, since 2023, 135 bills in 29 states have sought to influence university policies or curriculum. 29 states, 135 bills. Florida Stop Woke Act is the most famous of that. But red states are creating their own accrediting agencies. That goes under the radar. Those accrediting agencies are going to tell A&M, the University of Texas at Austin, you can teach this, you can't teach that. States are mandating the Western canon, so the elimination of diverse viewpoints that are not white men historically. States are implementing post-tenure review. So if I've been tenured for 25 years now, I'm going to get reviewed because my classes are too woke, right? Texas gave broad power to overrule curricular change to its state board of ed. Right? These things are happening at the lower level. They're not getting the same attention as the curricular one is, but they're slowly chipping away at the independence of our greatest asset, which is our colleges and universities.
I was wondering, what is gender ideology? You know, what did they mean by that? And they meant gender ideology is defined as a concept of self-assessed gender identity replacing and disconnected from the biological category of sex. And I just, you know, and also what is race ideology? Race ideology was defined as attempts to shame a particular race or ethnicity or anything that, quote, promotes activism on issues related to race or ethnicity rather than academic instruction. That's really harsh and very, very concerning. And I'm worried about the future of higher ed here. We also have an Indiana University faculty member who was removed because they used MAGA as and noted that MAGA could be considered a symbol of white supremacy. So this is really across the country and not just in Texas. I mean, part of me shrugs and says, well, it's Texas. You know, maybe you expect that in Texas. But, you know, I think you're seeing it spread across the country, and it's not just limited to Texas. So it's gravely concerning, especially combined with funding from the federal government. So you're going to see this reactive approach that's going to really silence people on university campuses.
And if people really want to see where this is headed, I hate to invoke Russia because I come from that Red Scare era. But this is a page out of Putin's Russia. That where is the line between advocacy that is prohibited in Russia, to advocate a gay or lesbian lifestyle is illegal in Russia. So where do you go with that? And what is it to just teach it? Where's the line between just teaching it and advocating it?
Discussing it. It's not advocating.
But the fear surrounding that, you know, and how detailed. I it's been a long time since I've been in college and opened up a course curriculum book, but they were pretty, you know, it was like three lines. Yeah. The book will teach about, you know, they might name the authors or something like that. That's about as far as they went in describing the curriculum. I assume they're still like that they don't get into deep, deep detail.
I mean, at Texas A&M, you got to get into deep, deep detail.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's going to have a chilling effect also, I would assume, on their ability to recruit faculty. I mean,
oh,
I think you're
sure.
going to see this sort of like division now between more liberalized colleges that take a different approach and the Texas A&Ms who aren't really going to be able to get people who want to think and write on their own.
Well, think even students, right?
Yeah, of course. But think about it's sort of a cliche to say this, but I'll say it anyway. The culture wars are being played out, battled on our college campuses, and that's happened in and out a lot. But think about, and I'll come back to Texas A&M, just this week, the battles over Turning Point USA at Berkeley, right? You know, the great liberal institution is literally taken to the streets and fighting in the streets over the existence of Turning Point USA. A&M has had a disastrous 40 months, right? Because there's more to what's happened at A&M. Remember this. So this was prompted primarily by the secret video that the student took of a, I think it was a philosophy professor, describing how there aren't just two genders. And the student was pushing back on that. That ends up getting the president, because the faculty member gets fired, the president then resigns because of the blowback there. That's on top of what happened 2 years ago when Kathleen McElroy, New York Times Journal editor, gets the deanship at A&M's School of Journalism. And she's a black woman who advocates for DEI, and the Board of Regents in Texas A&M revoked the offer for her. So A&M is the, interestingly enough, now the centerpiece of this culture war in higher ed.
And you just don't want it to set a bad precedent that they could then use in other institutions, saying like, hey, yes, Harvard, we've gone after your finances, we're trying to limit how many international students, we're trying, you know, now we can also go after your curriculum. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think
which is that, what they tried to do with that, with that, you know, the whatever it was, that, that agreement that the White House tried to get with seven or nine universities.
Yeah, so now they can say, hey, Texas A&M is doing it. You know, maybe these other 20 kind of Republican state schools start doing it, and then all of a sudden it's a commonplace thing that's happening.
We'll take a quick break. We'll wrap up on the other side right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you all with us. We just have a few moments. We'll wrap up. I just have a sort of here's a scenario, Bo. But you're a political science professor, and you're talking about the Supreme Court's decision this week not to take the Kim Davis case regarding gay marriage. So if you're a Texas A&M, how does that figure in? I mean, how do you do that without violating what they are saying in this?
I think
they went on yesterday.
Exactly, Joe. I think it's a very difficult dance that you. I mean, that Supreme Court decisions, whether it's Obergefell or the decision not to go with Kim Davis, that's part of the narrative about individual freedom and rights in this country, and you cannot fully explore it at A&M anymore. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is really, you know, just so dispiriting.
It was unanimous. That shocked me. I mean, I thought there would be at least some dissent. Like, the Board of Regents there is just 100% unified on this very controversial point. I mean, I guess they wanted to keep their seat, right?
For sure. And I think the interesting, I'll say one more thing, if you allow me, Joe, to and fellow panelists, about that, about the Kim Davis, I was surprised. I was shocked that the court was not going to take her case up because, of course, Alito and Thomas are very clear, whether it's Dobbs or whatever, Alito and Thomas are very clear that they want to revisit the same-sex marriage Obergefell decision. It seemed implausible that they couldn't get two other justices, right? The rule of four is if four justices want to take a case, they can. It will be put on the docket. It's implausible to me that they couldn't get two other justices. And I think this is the one moment in the last couple of years that Roberts was able to sort of assert some power and tell Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Gorsuch to back off. There's too many controversial cases at the moment. Let's not do this. And they agreed with him. I think Roberts actually had a hand in not taking the Kim Davis case.
But it was kind of a legacy of Roberts. You know, it was something on the more liberal side of the agenda that Roberts said, you know, this is for whatever reason he did. He said he was the deciding justice on this thing. I don't think he wants to see that torn apart. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, the one part I didn't understand about it, we only have about a minute and a half left, but the one thing I didn't understand about it is, so Kim Davis was going out for the $300,000 that she paid, and that was what we were suing on. And, oh, by the way, throw out gay marriage while you're at it.
Right.
Like, it seemed like a bonus. Like, I mean, none of it seemed to really be cohesive and a good case anyway.
Yeah, but it's give me. I mean,
I know.
Give me the next case that gives them an opportunity to throw it at Obergefell. You're not going to find it.
Yeah,
that one was at least one that was right in front of them.
All right, we have to call it a morning for the panel. My thanks to all of you for your comments and your thoughtfulness and your studying and being so wonderful. I hope you have a beautiful weekend. Jay Jochnowitz, March Gallagher, Bo Breslin, and Anna Markowitz. Thank you so much for being here. We'll continue with the program right after this.